Hello, Mike. And thank you. And hello, everyone else. And thank you, too, for coming and joining us together in our regular weekly slot here, courtesy of Mike Coles, newliferadio.co.uk, and with my contribution, I'm Ron Bailey from BibleBase.com. Welcome. We enjoy your company. I'm enjoying discovering new themes and lines as we go through this topic. If you're here for the first time, well, we are following the pattern of a book that I wrote about 10 years ago called The Better Covenant. And I've called this series The Better Covenant Revisited. That's not a rehash or just a statement of the original book, but actually it's using the book as a framework, but kind of looking at it and going through things again and adding things to it, and sometimes maybe missing some things out as well. This is the state of the art of my thinking concerning the New Covenant. You're as up to date as I am now. So this is The Better Covenant Revisited, Study 36, that I've called The End of the End. That's my working title, anyway. Before we move on, I want to give some attention to the way in which the Old Covenant was brought to an absolute end. This was not a steady transition. It wasn't a fading out of one and the fading in of the other, from an Old Covenant to a New Covenant. This was an abrupt change, a genuine paradigm shift. He takes away the first, says the writer to the Hebrews, that he might establish the second. Maybe Paul had this kind of thing in mind too when he said, if any man be in Christ, he has become a new creation. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. I want to illustrate that with thinking about a temple. So my first section is about a true temple. The king had come. The light shined, but in the main, the messenger of the covenant had not been received. In the way that a country might refuse to receive or recognize an ambassador from another country, so in the main, the covenant people refused to recognize Christ's role and authority. At the beginning of his public ministry, John, the gospel writer, recorded that Christ visited the temple in Jerusalem during the time of the Passover. He discovered that the court of the Gentiles had been wholly given over to a market, and the scene was one of bellowing cattle and bleating sheep. The officials who changed foreign currencies into temple currency had set up their stalls, and the whole atmosphere was of a bustling oriental bazaar. And this in the area that had been set aside for Gentiles who were seeking to worship the God of Israel. Christ plucked a small whip and drove the stallholders from the court of the Gentiles. Some have seen the scene as an outburst of rage and consequently sin, but it was not uncontrollable rage, but deliberate action. He took the time, for example, to fashion that small whip with which to herd the animals out, and then went into action. His war cry was, "This is my Father's house." He drove out those who had turned the house into a market, and later, when they considered these things, the disciples remembered an ancient psalm which seemed to explain it all. This is Psalm 69 and verse 8. "I am become a stranger unto my brethren, and an alien unto my mother's children. For the zeal of thy house hath eaten me up, and the reproaches of them that reproach thee are fallen upon me." He had been aroused to this action out of a sense of the disgrace that was being brought upon his Father's house by the behaviour of the covenant people. When the authorities protested at his behaviour, they demanded some evidence of his right to do such a thing. He replied that the sign of his authority would be his resurrection. Although he didn't say it quite so plainly as that. This is John chapter 2, verses 19 to 21. Jesus answered and said to them, "Destroy this temple." Remember, this is in response to their demand for a sign. Jesus answered and said to them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." Then the Jews said, "It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days?" But he was speaking of the temple of his body. It's interesting, they demanded a sign, and this was the greatest sign, but they wouldn't see it or respond to it for some 3.5 years. It's the sign of the resurrection. He knew that initially his words would be misunderstood by everyone who heard them, but he took the opportunity of sowing a seed in the midst, in the minds of those who would later bear witness to his resurrection. We're so familiar with these words and John's explanation of them that we easily miss the significance of the fact that Christ was regarding himself as a temple. And temples in Jewish history were places where God came to reside. Temples were God's residence. It's a theme that begins earlier in John's Gospel. A devout Israelite had become convinced of the identity of Jesus of Nazareth as the Messiah and expressed his conviction in a remarkable confession. This is John chapter 1, verse 49. It's Nathanael speaking. Nathanael answered and said to him, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." These two titles are impressive in themselves. Nathanael saw clearly who he was and what he'd come to do. To these amazing revelations, Jesus added another. And he, that's Jesus, said to him, that's Nathanael, "Most assuredly, I say to you, hereafter you shall see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man." John chapter 1, verse 51. Perhaps that is a little obscure until we realize that the story that Jesus had in mind comes from the very beginnings of God's dealings with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God revealed himself to these men, spoke to them, and then in turn entered into personal covenants with them. At one point, God revealed himself to Jacob in a dream. The dream terrified Jacob. He saw heaven and earth connected with free access to and fro. He saw a place where heaven touched earth and where the free intercourse between the two was expressed in a powerful image. Genesis 28, verse 10 following, "And Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran, and delighted upon a certain place and tarried there all night because the sun was set. And he took one of the stones of the place and put it under his head and lay down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God ascending and descending on it." And it says, following on, that Jacob awaked out of his sleep, and he said, "Surely Jehovah is in this place, and I knew it not." And he was afraid, and said, "How dreadful is this place! This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." We see here a combining of ideas. The house of God is marked by the presence of angels ascending and descending upon it. The house of God is in some ways almost like a kind of an embassy. It's a heavenly embassy upon the earth. And there's a lot of traffic to and fro. The angels are ascending and descending upon it. This temple is in touch with heaven. It's a heavenly outpost on earth where God actually resides. Nathanael was a devout Israelite, and these words of Jesus would have spoken to him much more clearly than they might speak to us today. Christ was saying, I am also the house of God. I am the place where God has chosen to take up residence. I'm not only the Messiah of your expectations, I am the access point to heaven itself. I am heaven's gate. And the thing that symbolized that free access to and fro is angels of God ascending and descending upon the place where Jacob had been sleeping. So let's think about a house for God. The four gospel accounts, and particularly John's record, have many layers of truths running through them. John's account has been called Love's Remembrance of Love's Story. I think that's a wonderful title for John's Gospel. Love's Remembrance of Love's Story. This account was written after some 60 years of loving meditation and reflection, and every sentence is pregnant with deeper significance. This is not a biography in the usual sense of that word, but a devotional in which the reader is invited to pause and contemplate the lasting significance of what may have seemed initially to be just passing events. Let's look backwards over our shoulder for a moment. The covenant people of Israel were chosen to be a kingdom of priests for God, a set-apart nation with a unique destiny. When the nation had confirmed their willingness to embrace the Sinai covenant, God began to open up to them a larger plan. God was not only going to take them to a promised land, he was going to take up residence among them. In their desert wanderings, and for some 300 to 400 years after that, God's residence was a simple shrine. Simple, that is, in its outward appearance. On the inside, it was a revelation of gold and silver and glory. The tabernacle or tent that was known as the holy place was created by a framework of gold-plated wooden frames. I think it's almost certain that these were not solid planks of gold-plated wood, but much more in the style of window frames. When these windows, this framework, was erected, the splendid first covering was draped over it, like a frame tent. This covering was elaborately embroidered with the forms of cherubim, angelic beings who were God's personal attendants. The result was that for the priests who were allowed into this holy place, which was the antechamber to the throne room, it was a vision in gold and silver and blue and red and purple of a room surrounded by angels. Every wall was filled with angels embroidered on the tapestry, seen through the frame. If they looked upwards, they saw the same serried ranks of angelic hosts looking towards the wall and the ceiling. Would have given an impression of countless angelic hosts. This was God's residence, and the angels of God were ascending and descending upon it. During the reign of Solomon, this portable palace was transformed into a magnificent palace for the king. It's good to remember that the tabernacle and the temple that followed it wasn't in one sense primarily like a church building. It wasn't a place where they went to sing hymns. It was a place where God resided among his people. That's the central truth of this tabernacle. It was David who had received the revelation, the design for the building, and it was David who had collected together the majority of the funds for this wonder of the world. David's feelings about it are very plain. This is 1 Chronicles 22, verse 5. And David said, Solomon, my son, is young and tender, and the house that is to be builded for Jehovah must be exceeding magnificent. The old King James Version says, exceeding magnifical. exceeding magnificence, of fame, of glory throughout all countries. I will therefore make preparation for it. So David prepared abundantly before his death. It's interesting to see that David is not only thinking about the covenant people when he designed the temple that Solomon built. There's a little cameo in the way this magnificent building might have worked in the story of the Queen of Sheba. She had heard rumors of the greatness of Solomon, his kingdom, and she abandoned her kingdom for a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. Solomon answers the questions about the God of Israel, but it is what she saw, literally, as the record runs, that took her breath away. 2 Chronicles 9, verses 2 following, and Solomon told her all her questions, and there was not anything hid from Solomon which he told her not. And when the Queen of Sheba had seen the wisdom of Solomon, and the house that he had built, and the food of his table, and the sitting of his servants, and the attendance of his ministers, and their apparel, his cupbearers also, and their apparel, and his ascent, by which he went up unto the house of Jehovah, there was no more spirit in her. The Hebrew word for spirit and breath are the same. It took her breath away. And she said to the king, "It was a true report that I heard in mine own land of thine acts and of thy wisdom." The temple was made of wood and stone and covered in gold, but the symbolism of the old tabernacle was faithfully reproduced. It tells us that Solomon's workmen, under his direction, and he carved all the walls of the house round about with carved figures of cherubim. There they are, the angelic attendants of God's presence. And palm trees and open flowers within and without. The priests who entered into the holy place were still surrounded by cherubim, even in Solomon's day. And they would see inscribed upon the walls now, and upon it the roof, the angels of God ascending and descending. Almost 1,000 years later, Herod the Great launched an elaborate and expensive building program. He built magnificent mini-Romes like Caesarea on the Mediterranean, and he rebuilt the temple to replace the smaller building that had been constructed during the time of Zerubbabel, Haggai, and Zechariah. It was a magnificent building. It might even be considered one of the wonders of the world, but it was never occupied, not by God. Zerubbabel's temple had never been occupied by God either. There was an essential missing feature that never returned from the Babylonian exile. The Ark of the Covenant never returned to Israel. The Ark of the Covenant, symbolically, was God's throne. No throne, no Shekinah presence of God. When the original tabernacle was erected, God took residence in such splendor and glory that even the priests were not able to minister there. The same thing happened when Solomon's temple was built. God took up residence in such splendor and glory that again the priests were unable to go about their ordinary work. But of Zerubbabel's temple and Herod's temple, there's no such record of God taking up residence. They both remained as empty palaces awaiting the arrival of the king. The centuries passed, and still the covenant people waited for the fulfillment of the prophecies. This is the last prophet of the Old Covenant Scriptures, Malachi chapter 3. "Behold, I send my messenger," that's John Baptist, "and he shall prepare the way before me." This is God speaking in the person, in the testimony of Christ. "And the Lord whom ye seek will suddenly come to his temple, and the messenger of the covenant," that's one of Christ's titles, "whom ye desire, behold, he comes, saith Jehovah of hosts." Long years they waited, And then in private conversation with Nathanael, and then public confrontation with the religious leaders, Jesus of Nazareth plainly declared himself to be not only the Christ, but also the place where God himself would reside. In him, they would see, if they would allow him to open their eyes, the splendor and glory of Emmanuel, God himself now with them. One of the sad stories, and it's easy to miss it, that we find in the Gospels is of an abandoned house. The better part of 3 years of public ministry followed, and in the last days of his earthly life, Christ returned to the temple in Jerusalem and found that it had simply slipped back into its old ways. In spite of his cleansing, everything had reverted to its original condition. And the court of the Gentiles was once again a bellowing, bleating market. Earlier that day he had viewed the city of Jerusalem and wept over it, sorrowing most of all because they had not known the day of God's visitation. It's recorded in Luke chapter 19, verse 44. When he entered the temple and found that they had gone back to their old ways, he repeated his action and drove out the market traders. This time his war cry was different. The first time he said, "This is my Father's house." This time he says, "It is written, my house is a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of fiends." It's a quotation that combines the words of two prophets, Isaiah and Jeremiah. Isaiah in chapter 56, verse 7 says, "Even them will I bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices shall be accepted upon mine altar, for my house shall be called a house of prayer for all peoples." That, of course, is a house of prayer for the Goyim, the nations, the Gentiles. And then Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 11. Is this house which is called by my name become a den of robbers in your eyes? Behold, even I have seen it, said Jehovah. The Jeremiah quotation is particularly ominous. It was first declared some 10 years before Solomon's beautiful temple was sacked and burned to the ground. There's a saying that history repeats itself because no one listens the first time. Is this one of the reasons that when people tried to work out who Jesus was, one of their answers was, "It's Jeremiah, or one of the prophets"? On the second occasion of cleansing, Christ refers to the temple as my house. Later he'll go on to predict the destruction of Herod's masterpiece, in which not one stone of the temple itself will be left standing on another. But in the order of Matthew's gospel, before he pronounced the death sentence for Herod's temple, he said something much more chillingly. "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. For I say to you, you shall see me no more till you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" My Father's house, then my house, and finally, your house. He has disowned it. It fitted the pattern of an earlier parable in which the tenant said, this is Luke chapter 20, "And when the vine dressers saw him, they reasoned among themselves, saying, 'This is the heir. Come, let us kill him, that the inheritance may be ours.'" The inheritance became theirs, but it was not taken by them, but left to them. God had left it abandoned. What are we to make of all those promises of an everlasting covenant made with Levi, and the lamps that would burn everlastingly? In AD 70, the Roman armies under Titus were engaged in a bloody battle at Jerusalem. The nation had revolted, and Rome's iron boot was stamping down firmly. In July AD 70, the final sacrifice was offered, and it was all over. The writer of Hebrews, writing just 5 or so years before the event, linked it to the promise of Jeremiah's new covenant, and declared in that he says, a new covenant, he has made the first obsolete. Now what is becoming obsolete and growing old is about to vanish away. Hebrews 8:13. For the writer of the letter to the Hebrews, the writing was on the wall, and the end of the temple was an inevitability. And of course, there remains just the plinth upon which it stood. The tabernacle, temple, and its sacrifices were an essential part of the Sinai covenant, not an optional extra. They were what earlier we called its maintenance element. The elements of covenant people, covenant law, and covenant priesthood are inseparable. They create an integrated entity. If one of these elements fails, the whole structure becomes unworkable. Perhaps we can illustrate with a less well-known passage of Scripture, the sacrifice of the red heifer. The sacrifice of the red heifer is mentioned in passing in Hebrews, but you will search for it in vain in the list of sacrifices in the book of Leviticus. It appears in the book of Numbers, and that is significant. The book of Numbers takes its name from the census that was taken when the covenant people were about to start their brief march, 11 days, and their conquest of Canaan. How is the sacrificial system of the Sinai covenant going to be kept in good order while the nation is on the march and engaged in battle? Each time they'll move, they will have to dismantle and then reassemble the tabernacle before the sacrificial system can be up and running again. And there's another issue. Only clean priests can operate the sacrificial system. What happens if a priest is defiled by coming into contact with a dead body? An almost inevitable event in the time of war. Well, a clean priest could perform the necessary sacrifices, and the defiled priest could be cleansed by the clean priest. But what if they were all defiled by contact with the dead body? Now what? Enter the sacrifice of the red heifer. We'll see what happens when the cycle is broken. The sacrifice of the red heifer is a unique kind of sin offering. It's specifically called a sin offering in Hebrews, and it's part of that pattern. The writer of the Hebrews puts it in that context, Hebrews 9, verse 13. In this sacrifice, a red heifer, without blemish, was taken outside the camp, as the main sin offerings were, and there the animal was slaughtered. Some of the blood was kept. Some of the blood was then sprinkled in front of the tabernacle precincts. The heifer was then burned in its entirety, and its ashes were added with various other ingredients. The priest who officiated, a clean priest, was now regarded as ceremonially defiled because he'd been handling the sin offering, and he and his clothes had to be thoroughly washed. Next, another clean man, a different one, gathers up the ashes of the mingled sacrifice and other ingredients and preserves them in a safe, that is to say, a clean place outside the main camp. This created a reserve sacrifice, a kind of instant sacrifice that could be quickly reconstituted in a time of emergency. It seems that the preserved sacrifice could be instantly reconstituted simply by adding fresh or living water. Hence, an instant sin offering in a container of some kind, kept reserved, ready for the emergency. In a later time, the sacrifice would be used for the cleansing of defiled priests, and the priests, once cleansed, could commence his ministry, and the cycle was active again. So even if the whole thing ground to a halt because there was sin and not a single priest was operating, well, it wasn't the end of the cycle because they had the red ashes in a safe place, in a clean place, available for an instant sacrifice. It's a wonderful system. But perhaps you've seen the catch. What happens if all the priests are ceremonially unclean, having been in contact with dead bodies or the sin offering, and if there is no reserve red heifer ashes available? In other words, if the priests, all of them, are unclean because they've touched a red body, and there's no reserve red heifer ashes, now what? We can see that the whole system grinds to a halt. There is no clean priest to create the red heifer ashes, and there are no red heifer ashes to cleanse the priest. Once this cycle has broken down, it is impossible to get it up and running again. No red heifer ashes, and the whole system quickly grinds to a halt. There are no red heifer ashes. There are no clean priests to create red heifer ashes. It cannot be repaired. It cannot be restarted. The law and its sacrificial system was perfectly integrated as an institution, but once any element of it was broken, the whole machine falters. The sacrifice of the red heifer may seem obscure to our modern eyes, but it's the telling illustration of the way in which, once broken, the old covenant could never be put together again, simply by human determination. You can't just start off where the last priests finished. There would have to be a resetting of the Sinai covenant and a new Moses. The Sinai covenant was originally initiated by Moses. It was attended by miracles of God's presence. A wind that divided between the Egyptians and the Israelites, and the fiery presence on Sinai itself. It was then maintained by a series of sacrifices and ceremonies. To reconstitute the Sinai covenant, it would be necessary to have another mediator, and another infusion of wind and fire, the production of the raw materials themselves, red heifer and other ingredients, could not in themselves be sufficient. It would require a new mediator and a new priest, and essentially a complete repeat of the events of Sinai. It would require nothing less than a new covenant. The Sinai covenant, once halted, can never be restarted by human agency. It would need to be a new beginning, instituted by God, and not the mere rekindling of an old fire. The Sinai covenant will never be restarted. There is no need. God has promised and provided a new covenant with a new mediator and a new priest, and that covenant is up and running. Judaism regards quite rightly the Sinai covenant as the beginning of the nation's unique identity. Judaism also regards the Jewish feast weeks, or weeks, or Pentecost, as the anniversary of the giving of the law. It's called the Feast of Weeks because it takes place 7 times 7 after Passover. Christians know it better as the 50th day, or in Greek, Pentecost. Christ died at the time of the Passover, and 50 days later, when the day of Pentecost had fully come, there was an amazing event which included fire and wind, those ancient attendants of the Exodus, and God arriving in the person of the Holy Spirit to take up residence in his new temple. The same God had been resident in the person of his Son, had now come to take up residence in the new covenant people. Initially, it would be a remnant of the house of Israel and of the house of Judah, but soon it will include a unique and secret ingredient. This is Ephesians chapter 3. This is Paul's great secret. Verses 4 to 6. By which, when you read, you may understand my knowledge in the mystery, that's the secret of Christ, which in other ages was not made known to the sons of men. Notice that. The new covenant, the mystery of Christ, in other ages was not made known to the sons of men, as it has now been revealed by the Spirit to his holy apostles and prophets, that the Gentiles should be fellow heirs of the same body and partakers of his promise in Christ through the gospel. The new temple of the church was created to fulfill God's desire for his house to be a house of prayer in which he is resident. In this chapter, we examined the references in which Christ referred to himself as the temple and saw the significance that he claimed to be the place where God was in residence. We saw the dreadful finality with which he disowned the physical temple of his day, and that once broken, the Sinai covenant can never be restarted. We examined the special emergency measure of the sacrifice of the red heifer and saw that once broken, this pattern too could never be restarted. And we saw the significance of the day of Pentecost as the anniversary of Sinai on the plain declaration that the new covenant was now up and running and that God was again resident in his temple. We'll pause there until the next exciting installment. He takes away the first that he may establish the second. He had to establish the first. He had to establish the second. No group of men, no matter how pious, no matter how earnest, no matter how sincere, can create, recreate the old Sinai covenant. And no one other than Christ can recreate the new covenant. But that high priest lives on still. He's resident in the heavenly temple, and he's resident in the earthly temple of his people. Thank you again for your company. Do tell us your reactions to these things, and that's always a joy for us. Just to have a contact with you is always a joy for us. So, thank you again, and God willing, we look forward to your company. Same time, same place. Thanks. Goodbye.